Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1033, interview number 3 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 20th of the year 2018. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airways Jim DiGiamio, the author of the triumphal account of JFK's assassination and Jim Garrison's investigation of Same Destiny Betrayed. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
Before we get into the subject material at hand, I want to remind people that, of course, we're getting into the holiday season, and one could, I think, for someone who is politically and intellectually inclined, I think the giving of Destiny Betrayed as a gift would be a superb way to enhance not only the holidays but the future itself. We'll talk more about the book, about where to get the book, and where you can peruse more information about Jim at the end of this talk. Now, in our first couple of talks, for the record 1031 and 32, we were talking about JFK's political vision and how he was way ahead of his time in being able to divorce the anti-colonial struggle on the part of many countries that had been or were trying to become, that had been European colonies and were trying to or had just achieved their freedom. He was able to separate that from the Cold War dynamic that clouded and embraced so much of that as far as the U.S. and the West was concerned. That applied to Vietnam. We'll be talking more about that in our future talks. Laos, the Congo, Indonesia, and Cuba. We talked about how under Fulgencio Batista, Cuba had been something of a corporate wet dream for U.S. commercial interests. Eventually, his plutocracy in Cuba alienated so many of the Cuban population, and frankly, many people in this country, that a rebellion by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara was ultimately successful. There were attempts on the part of elements associated with CIA to moderate Batista's situation and replace him with a suitable surrogate. That did not take place, and Castro came to power. The Bay of Pigs invasion, a fundamentally flawed plan that Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, dismissed by Kennedy and ultimately serving on the Warren Commission, admitted he knew was flawed, but he went through with that plan. The idea was to have Kennedy ride to the rescue with the military and get rid of Castro. That did not take place. General Maxwell Taylor presided over the issuance of a very critical report pointing out how flawed the Bay of Pigs plan was to begin with. And then Kennedy's White House generated NSAMs 55, 56, and 57, which to a large extent shifted the fundamentals of future paramilitary and covert operations from the CIA to the Pentagon. We also spoke about how Charles Murphy, ghostwriting in, Charles Murphy served as something of a literary front in Fortune magazine for not only Alan Dulles, but a CIA operative and future Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt that not distorted but lied about the Bay of Pigs and laid it on the responsibility on Kennedy's inability to wield power properly. And we spoke about this in our last talk, and sticking with the subject of Cuba, one of the most important events in the 20th century, one that could certainly have ended our civilization had it not gone properly, and that was the Cuban Missile Crisis. I've noted, Jim, before I turn the analysis over to you for this pivotal event, this coming Thursday is not only the anniversary of JFK's assassination, but it is also Thanksgiving. And I think we can all be very thankful indeed that JFK was president at that time instead of any one of a number of other people or just about anyone else. Jim, tell us about the Cuban Missile Crisis, how it developed, and just what JFK was up against, not just abroad, but in his own cabinet and joint chiefs.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, most analysts today, and the foremost analyst, Graham Allison of Harvard, and I agree with him on this. I believe the motivation for Khrushchev's sending what was essentially a first strike nuclear armada into Cuba was as a result of the Vienna summit in the latter part of 1961, after which Kennedy was very worried that the Russians were going to make a play for West Berlin. After that, if you recall, there was kind of a mini crisis in Berlin, all right, in which the United States and the Soviets had tanks meeting at the Brandenburg Gate, and JFK and his brother very fortunately went ahead and de-escalated that crisis, all right? And so Kennedy was very, very much worried about this because in understanding Kennedy's thinking, see, someplace like Vietnam, to him, that was not part of the security sphere of the United States, all right? But someplace like Berlin, which was right in the middle of Germany there, and West Germany was a very integral part of the Atlantic Alliance. Kennedy was not going to let that happen because to him that could roll up the whole European alliance, which Kennedy thought was very, very important. So once Khrushchev goes ahead and in secret, and this was made it even more disturbing, in secret, he launches all three arms of the triad into Cuba. And what I mean by that is that the triad consists in atomic weapons back then. It was ballistic missiles, all right, the atomic submarines, all right, and atomic bombers. And he sent all three into Cuba, all right? And so once the U-2 flights that are going over Cuba pick up these things, and it's undeniable that they're there, Kennedy still tried to de-escalate it, you know, by talking to the Russian ambassador there, and it didn't work, all right? And so once he tried to broach the subject and the Russian representatives denied it, then he went ahead and called together the meetings of the EXCOM. This was a combination of the cabinet positions, the vice president, and Bobby Kennedy, and Ted Sorensen, and to a lesser extent, Ken O'Donnell. All right? Now, it's very interesting why he did that, because, see, after the Bay of Pigs, first of all, Kennedy installed a taping system after that because he did not like the way that people were telling the press that somehow that was not a unanimous cabinet decision to go ahead with the Bay of Pigs, when in fact it was such a unanimous cabinet decision. And secondly, he now did not trust these guys, these upper CIA level guys and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for advice. So he wanted to bring in some people who he was very familiar with, all right? And so that's why he brought in RFK, Sorensen, and Kenny O'Donnell, all right? And so Now what happens is there begins to be a series of debates about how we're going to counteract this thing. And reading those things, there's a nice book on this called The Kennedy Tapes, which is a transcription of the audio tapes from the whole crisis. It's very clear that of the large majority, in fact, it's almost unanimous, all right, wants to either, one, invade the island, or, number two, bomb the missile silos. Okay? Those are the two ones that almost everybody wants to do. All right? And it's actually Kennedy who, this is beautiful to read. It's really beautiful to read. Because somebody will suggest, okay, let's bomb the missile silos. And Kennedy would say, all right, if we're going to bomb the missile silos, what's the percentage of direct hits you're going to get on the silo? And the guy would say, oh, maybe 50%. All right. How far away are the other bombs going to strike? And he would go, well, you know, like maybe 5 miles, maybe. Okay. So how many civilian deaths are we talking about? Okay. So it would inevitably get into the hundreds and then the thousands. All right. And JFK, I have to give this guy credit for this. He was one of the very few presidents who really gave a damn about killing innocent civilians. You know, Nixon and Johnson and Eisenhower didn't give, you know, two craps about that. You know, but he really did. All right. And so after he goes through all these things, these alternatives, somebody, I think it was McNamara, suggested the blockade. We can blockade the island. All right. And so Kennedy latches on to that. Although, by the way, if you read it closely, it's actually Kennedy who's the first guy who suggests a blockade. But nobody liked it. All right. And so when McNamara then suggested it, Kennedy jumped on it. And that ended up being a major part of the solution to the crisis. Now, during these meetings, as the blockade's going on, Kennedy goes ahead and starts talking to some of these people. You know, he calls them into their office. He goes to visit them. When he met the Joint Chiefs, you know, led by Curtis LeMay, you know, they essentially kind of insulted him. And they said, this is Munich. You know, this is surrender. And, you know, and so JFK said, all right, now, if you want to go ahead and move on Cuba, what's to stop the Russians from moving on Berlin? All right, and that's the question he asked. And they said, well, we don't think they're going to do it. And JFK says, well, that's not good enough, okay? You know, you guys are involved in this, and you're involved in this with me, all right? You know, and by the way, that was the first and only meeting that he had with the Joint Chiefs during the entire 13 days. So what happens is that Khrushchev sends a message to the State Department, okay, asking for a solution. And around the same time, JFK sends Bobby Kennedy to the Russian ambassador, all right? And they go ahead, between those two moves, that is what goes ahead and de-escalates the whole crisis, all right? And thank God that happened, because as I think you understand, and I think most people understand, if Khrushchev and Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy did not come up with a peaceful solution, there very likely would have been World War III. Because, as you know, the armada that the Russians had sent into Cuba consisted of essentially a first strike.
Jim, I'd like to interrupt at this point and actually read from page 66 of the soft cover edition of your book. And I have to say that I was not aware of the full array of military forces that the Soviets had in Cuba. From page 66 of Destiny Betrayed, the deployment included 40 land-based ballistic missile launchers, including 60 missiles in 5 missile regiments. The medium-range missiles had a range of 1,200 miles. The long-range ones, 2,400 miles. In addition, there were to be 140 air defense missile launchers to protect the sites. Accompanying them would be a Russian army of 45,000 men with 4 motorized rifle regiments and over 250 units of armor. There would also be a wing of MiG-21 fighters with 40 nuclear-armed IL or Ilyushin 28 bombers. Finally, there was to be a submarine missile base with an initial deployment of 11 submarines, 7 of them capable of launching 1 megaton nuclear warheads. In addition, there were low-yield tactical nuclear weapons for coastal defense in case of an invasion. That is a formidable military force, and one of the things that comes to mind is I think it was the elder German General von Moltke who said, quote, "No battle plan survives contact with the enemy intact." In other words, even if the Joint Chiefs, who viewed Kennedy as a lily-livered coward, and I don't think that would be much of an exaggeration. Calling him an appeaser along the lines of Neville Chamberlain at Munich is pretty much saying that. Even if the go-ahead had been given to bomb the missiles, I don't know if they would have been in silos, and most medium-range missiles, I think, were were not in hardened silos, but that's immaterial. If they had launched those strikes, and even if that had been accompanied by, say, commando raids or a naval bombardment or whatever, I think it is extraordinarily unlikely that they would have been able to get all of those forces. And if any of those had struck back, if one submarine, I don't know if they were there, if they had been able to fire one missile or one of the intermediate range missiles or one bomber, and they wouldn't have even had to hit the U.S. proper if they had been able to destroy the naval armada in the Caribbean. It's highly unlikely they would have taken out all of that, and there would have been a Third World War. We would not be here today. I think on this coming Thursday, as I said, we could give thanks that JFK was president and not someone else. The last comment I'm going to make before I turn things back over to you, Jim, is Sun Tzu in his Art of War noted that the greatest victory is one that is achieved, without resorting to conflict on a battlefield. In other words, if you can achieve your objectives without firing a shot, or in his day, a bow, that was the greatest of all victories. And I think Sun Tzu, or perhaps his spirit, would have been applauding JFK, because if he had not successfully used diplomacy, we wouldn't be here.
Yes, I agree with that. Now, after the missile crisis, what happens is something that I think is kind of unexpected. First of all, there's a split between the Russians and the Cubans because Castro felt that Khrushchev had isolated him from the talks to resolve the crisis, all right? And it was essentially the deal that they made was that the Russians would remove the nuclear armada from the island in return for a promise, or the Americans would not invade Cuba. Since Kennedy didn't have any intention of invading Cuba, he really didn't have to give up very much at all, all right? But something happened in that this led to a relaxation of tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the back channel between the White House and Havana. All right? And so what happened is that Kennedy, through several intermediaries, okay, and some of them were the reporter Lisa Howard, State Department employee William Atwood, and French journalist John Daniel, they set up a kind of, let's call it, an informal discussion about perhaps ratcheting down the tensions between the United States and Cuba. Castro, by the way, I have to say, Castro's the guy who first proposed this, all right? And to his credit, JFK picked up the ball, all right? And he did it sort of secretly, but it's very apparent that as the talks went further and further, they began in December of 1962, and they went on through 1963. And as JFK brought in people like McGeorge Bundy, the CIA found out about these. And not only did they find out about it, but the anti-Castro Cuban exiles also found out about it. So as JFK decommissions Operation Mongoose, you know, the secret war against Cuba, as that gets, you know, cut back and cut back and cut back and cut back, the Cuban exiles now decide, uh-oh, looks like this is going to all be over. All right? And so what happens is a very, very curious attempt to create what you call a casus belli, that is creating disturbances in the Caribbean to go ahead and stop this rapprochement between Kennedy and Castro. And some of them, of course, we all know that the CIA and the mob had a kind of informal alliance to go ahead and assassinate Fidel Castro. And that continued in 1962 and 1963 with something called the AMLASH Project, all right, in which the CIA got in contact with a disaffected Cuban named Rolando Cubella and tried to get him to pull off an assassination attempt against Fidel. There was also something called Operation Tilt, which was a combination of CIA, Cuban exiles, and private industrialist named William Pauley to sponsor a raid into Cuba that was supposed to be based upon the mythology that the missiles were still there. All right? And that was sponsored, by the way, in the belief that we had to go, the Cuban exiles wanted to go ahead and screw up detente. That was a specific reason for it. All right? Now, those, of course, all failed. None of them worked out. The detente went ahead, and there's this incredible meeting between Jean Daniel, who, by the way, is still alive, and Castro, after Atwood recommended Daniel to Kennedy as being a messenger to a message to, because he was going to interview Castro, into Cuba, all right? And the message that he gave to Daniel was really really kind of remarkable, because it essentially said, I understand how bad things were under Batista, all right? And we don't want to go back to that, all right? The only thing I want from you is a kind of reassurance that you will not spread communist revolution into South America. If you agree to do that, then we can go ahead and establish a relationship between the two countries, right? And I have to say, Daniel's report on that, when Castro got that message, he was exuberant, all right? He goes, oh, my God. Kennedy will go down in history as the greatest American president since Lincoln, all right? And so I think we all know what happened. Just a couple of days later, they were at some restaurant, and Castro got a private message to pick up the phone, and he got the news that Kennedy was shot. And he very memorably said three times, this is bad news. And then he got the word that Kennedy was dead. And he turned to Danielle and said, everything has changed. Everything is going to change. All right? And that is, of course, what happened, because it was all over. The detente between Washington and Havana was pretty much ended with the assassination of President Kennedy, which, of course, some people believe might have been one of the reasons that he was killed.
Yeah, I think, Jim, a point that we should underscore here, and that is when we were talking in our first two talks about Kennedy's understanding of the desire for colonial and former colonial properties to maintain independence, and his ability to divorce that from Cold War dynamics. Although Castro was, of course, a communist, he was primarily a Cuban nationalist. And one of the schisms that was inherent in this aborted plan of détente between Kennedy and Castro was that between Castro and his aide, the more dogmatic, perhaps international communist, unquote, Che Guevara, in this context. You know, this is a part of history that we simply don't get taught. We don't hear about this. And having lived through that time, if they weren't already sufficiently motivated to kill Kennedy, the prevailing national security view of Kennedy at this point would have been that he was a card-carrying Red, and that would have sealed his fate.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
In Destiny Betrayed, Jim, you talk about the role of the entire Cuban imbroglio with the dramatis persona, the cast of characters who figure not only in the New Orleans aspect of the anti-Castro Cuban efforts, but also Jim Garrison's investigation. And although this will certainly be redundant with our future discussion when we actually get to Jim Garrison's investigation of this crew, I'd like to ask you to, and this is a tall order here, but to pick some of the major people, some of the major names that our listeners will be hearing, and place them in the context of this Cuban scenario, or in the context of matters Cuban, because, of course, New Orleans was a major focal point of anti-Castro sentiment and also a major epicenter of American and South American trade. Let's start with David Ferry. Who was he, and how does he fit into the Cuban context?
All right. Ferry was a what we would call a CIA trainer in things like small arms training, all right, and even underwater demolition, okay? And he was also a pilot. So, in other words, he went into Cuba dropping supplies into what the CIA thought would be areas where resistance against Castro was prominent, all right? And he was also directly involved in training for the Bay of Pigs. All right, we know that. It's very solid information, because there was a naval depot, a retired naval depot called the Belle Chasse Depot, which the CIA used to train some of these Cuban exiles. And it was completely CIA sanctioned. And the arms came in from the agency. And we know because one of the guys who was trained there knew Ferry and said, yeah, David Ferry was a trainer there. And he told me about it. All right. Now, he was also a trainer during the Mongoose operation. We also know that because he actually talked about that. All right. So, and he was very close friends with a guy named Sergio Arcacha Smith, who actually worked in Cuba for a number of years for the Cuban government as a representative, all right, who turned against Castro when Castro came to power. And the CIA had people in Cuba like David Phillips at this time, and they went ahead and tried to recruit people who had fallen out of love with the Castro Revolution. Sergio Arcacha Smith was one, Antonio Veciana was another one, and they actually arranged for people like this to come into in this particular case, into New Orleans. And Sergio Arcacha Smith then teamed up with a guy named Howard Hunt to work on this alleged government in exile, which is the CIA called the Cuban Revolutionary Council. And it was, since Hunt spoke fluent Spanish, then he kind of organized a lot of these mini branches in major cities throughout the Southeast, okay? And he was instrumental in creating them. And Sergio Arcacha Smith was supposed to be the head of the CRC in New Orleans, all right? Now, Clay Shaw was also part of this gun-running apparatus into Miami, Florida. We know that from a friend of his who talked to a Garrison investigator, all right, about that, that he, the chairman of the International Trademark, was part of a gun-running operation into Florida. And he was also part of an effort to get pilots, okay, into action out of Florida bases, you know, for raids into Cuba. So he was a part of it also. Now, Guy Bannister, who I think we're all familiar with because of the movie JFK, was a guy who had a multifaceted background in the Office of Naval Intelligence, the FBI. He was temporarily employed by the New Orleans Police Department, and he was retired from that when he set up something called, what he called an investigative agency, but which I think most of us realize today did very little investigative work and was really more a kind of front for extreme right-wing activity, which included, monitoring leftists, what he considered leftists, at local college campuses, you know, and also being a part of an arms drop-off for the Bay of Pigs and arms training for Operation Mongoose. And we have really good information about this today because Bob Tannenbaum, the deputy chair of the House Select Committee, who I met many years ago, said he actually saw a film of one of his training activity in which he brought in witnesses, and as they were watching the film, they identified Phillips, Bannister, and Oswald as part of that film. Okay? Now, there's also another branch to this, and this is what Oswald was doing. All right? I think most of us can agree today that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee was heavily infiltrated by the agency. And there were two people who were running that operation in 61 and part of 1962 for the CIA, and they were James McCord and David Phillips. All right? And so this is very interesting because not only did Tannenbaum see that film, which he brought in witnesses and they identified Phillips as being in the film, but there was an attempt to get a fundraising telethon going on in New Orleans in 1961 for the Cuban exiles. And people like Ed Butler were part of it, who was very active in the whole Cuban exile, raising funds and awareness of them, their cause. And a guy named Gordon Novell, who was very, very good at electronics, he gave a deposition in which he described a guy named Phillips at the meetings that took place in Bannister's office about this very telethon effort. Okay, and the description is very close to David Phillips, all right? Now, we also, of course, have the Maurice Bishop story with Antonio Vesciana, which he revealed to Gayton Fonzi for the Days of the Church Committee, in which Bishop recruited him out of Cuba, had him do several missions, one of them an assassination attempt on Castro. And then, as these machinations were dying down in the fall of 1963, was supposed to meet Bishop at the Southland Building in Dallas. He got there a little early, and he said that as he got there, Oswald was there, meeting with Bishop. And they were very briefly there for the same time, okay? And later on, of course, Vesciana admitted he would never do this with Gayton Fonzi during the House Select Committee on Assassinations. But many years later, I'm talking about the new millennium, he finally admitted that Maurice Bishop was Phillips. And then we also have Phillips's dying conversation with his brother James. They had been estranged over this whole CIA Kennedy assassination thing. And as Phillips was dying, talked to his brother, and his brother asked him, "Were you in Dallas on the day Kennedy was killed. And Phillips reluctantly admitted that, yes, he was. All right? And that's, those are the last words that the brothers ever exchanged.
This was in 1988.
Yes.
So this was many years after. Jim, I'd like to jump in just briefly and highlight some of the names that we have spoken about so far. David Ferry, as we will see when we get into Jim Garrison's actual investigation and the trial. David Ferry was the first person Garrison was after. He died. It was alleged to have been a suicide. I'm skeptical of that, and you provide ample information that that was not the case. Then the aforementioned Clay Shaw, about whom we will have much more to say in the future, became the person whom Garrison placed in the defendant's dock at his trial. Guy Bannister. Clay Shaw, by the way, was played by Tommy Lee Jones in the movie. David Ferry played by, what was the name of that actor?
David Ferry was played by Joe Pesci.
Joe Pesci, at beginning with a P. And Guy Bannister by Ed Asner. So if people have seen the movie, that may help to jar their memories. And again, David Atlee Phillips, one of the principal CIA people involved with the Americas, involved with the Guatemala operation and the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz, and then deeply involved with the anti-Castro effort. And he and future Watergate burglar James McCord, involved with attempting to neutralize the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a pro-Castro organization in the U.S., and Antonio Veciana of Alpha 66 worked with, quote, Maurice Bishop, who turned out to have been David Atlee Phillips. And in his dying conversation with his brother, Bishop / Phillips admitted that he had been in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Going back to the Bannister operation at the Janus Face 531 Lafayette Place, 544 Camp Street, tell us about Carlos Bringuier and the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, DRE.
All right. What you're talking about is a group that the acronym was a DRE that was operating out of more than one southern city, okay, but they did have an outpost in New Orleans. Now, Oswald talked to Bringuier, right, in, I think, late July, early August, okay, about joining his group. And then, about a week and a half later, Bringuier said that he heard about this, what he called a gringo, handing out pro-Castro leaflets on Canal Street. And so he walks over there, and he starts challenging Oswald to a fight, okay, because he felt that he had been, well, you wanted to be one of us, and now you're really one of these pro-Castro guys, etc. And what's really interesting about this is that there was actually a court hearing about it. And by all the observations, it was Bringuier who challenged Oswald and even threw a punch at him. And Bringuier gets off, and Oswald has to pay a fine for disturbing the peace. Okay. And then it gets even more interesting because Oswald then goes on two programs in the New Orleans area, and he debates Bringier and Ed Butler, and one of these programs is directly related to the NBC outlet in New Orleans called WDSU, which is owned by the Stern family, very wealthy members of the Sears Roebuck fortune, and who are very close friends of Clay Shaw, right? And so on this program, Oswald gets outed as being a defector to the Soviet Union, all right? And most people believe that they got that information from Washington in order to booby-trap the interview with Oswald. It later turns out, and this is exceedingly interesting, that when the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the mid to late 70s was investigating the Kennedy case, the CIA liaison on New Orleans and the DRE was a guy named George Ioannidis, okay? And the CIA said he was not in any way, shape, or form involved with the DRE at the time of the Kennedy assassination. It turns out this was a big lie. Ioannidis not only was connected, he was a very important paymaster for the DRE, all right? And he was a very, very high-level propaganda officer within the CIA. So in other words, the CIA deliberately lied. And by the way, I should add one other thing, that when Ioannidis was brought in, this is when the whole investigation of the CIA began to go south. Because now, instead of cooperating with the committee, the CIA began obstructing the committee. And I know this for a fact because I talked to Dan Hardway, who was, along with Eddie Lopez, the co-authors of the famous Mexico City report. And he told me that when Ioannidis took over the liaisonship, all right, he now had to wait days for documents. And then when he got the documents, there would be several missing pages, and sometimes they would be redacted, okay? And this was, of course, a stalling effort, you know, by the CIA to hope that it would run out, which it did. Okay, the HSCA days were numbered, all right? So that's how bad the CIA was on Oswald in New Orleans, all right? Now, Sergio Arcacha Smith, which I've talked a little bit about already, he was earlier linked to 544 Camp Street in the early days, 1961, 62, and then he moved to Dallas, okay? All right, and he had been a part of the CRC, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, in New Orleans in the early days, but he had been accused of embezzling money, so he left the city, and he went to Dallas, and of course, there's a very interesting story about that, which we'll get to later, about him and a woman named Rose Sheramy. All right. Now, another person is Bernardo de Torres, who had been part of the Bay of Pigs operation. And he had a meteoric career in the Central Intelligence Agency and ended up working with a guy named Mitch Rebell. Mitch Rebell was a incredibly skilled arms specialist that worked for the Central Intelligence devising weapons for them. Bernardo de Torres, in a really strange kind of a way, tries to infiltrate Jim Garrison's office in the latter part of 1966. And a very interesting memo that Garrison got was that within a 24-hour period after David Ferry so mysteriously passed away, a guy named Eladio Del Valle, who had worked in the Cuban government and had left Cuba and then had worked with Ferry, giving him money for infiltration plane flights into Cuba, his body was found, and the words were sort of like, killed gangland style in the proximity of Bernardo de Porra's apartment. All right? Very, very interesting character, to say the least, Bernardo de Porra.
As I recall, Jim, Eladio Del Valle was found shot through the heart, tortured, and with his head split open by a machete.
That's correct.
That does not sound like an accidental death,
and
that was
not at all.
It was very shortly after David Ferry died too.
Right.
And
maybe
you'd like to synopsize links between Del Valle and Ferry before we move on to some of the other Cuban dramatis personae here.
Yeah, like I said earlier, Eladio Del Valle was a paymaster for David Ferry on his missions going into Cuba and dropping in supplies and weapons into what the CIA thought would be nests of dissidents still on the island, all right? And he had worked in the Cuban government, like Sergio Arcacha Smith, all right, before he fled the Cuban government. And I should also add that there's some reliable reports that Del Valle was linked to Santo Traficante with drug running at around this time. So he was a very interesting character, you know, with a lot of different connections who, you know, talk about a body blow to your investigation. To have Ferry mysteriously leave this mortal coil and to have Del Valle killed gangland style, those were two really serious blows to Garrison's investigation, all right, to put it mildly, all right? Now, I've talked about E. Howard Hunt, who was, well, where do you begin with this guy? E. Howard Hunt was a very important member of the whole Bay of Pigs operation from the CIA's point of view, because he was sort of like their liaison to the Cuban exiles. In other words, because he spoke fluent Spanish, he was very important in organizing what Eisenhower called the government in exile, because this is what Eisenhower insisted on being really strong before he gave the okay to go ahead and launch an invasion of Cuba, because the Bay of Pigs operation was planned during the Eisenhower administration, all right, but it changed shape after the election of 1960 from a guerrilla force that was supposed to infiltrate the island into more or less a strike force, all right, which was supposed to launch a kind of D-Day type invasion. Well, it was Howard Hunt who was tasked with the job of building up and organizing the government in exile. And E. Howard Hunt was very much to say that this guy didn't like Kennedy is a monumental understatement. He really despised JFK, and I'm not exaggerating at all. I know somebody who interviewed him for a magazine article, and he said, oh, Jim, man, when Hunt got started on JFK, I almost had to leave the room, okay? There was nothing but venom about Kennedy, all right? And because, of course, it was Hunt who was so instrumental in putting that false story together for Charles Murphy to publish in Fortune magazine about how Kennedy had blown the Bay of Pigs operation by canceling the D-Day airstrikes, which was complete propaganda. All right, everybody in the CIA knew at least 1 month before the Bay of Pigs operation that there would be no D-Day airstrikes, that he wanted those performed from on the island. And the fact that the Cubans could not establish a beachhead stopped that from happening. Now, Hunt was also important because during, as you mentioned at the top of the show, the Maxwell Taylor hearings, which was the White House investigation into the failure of the Bay of Pigs. He became the attaché to Alan Dulles. And if you go ahead and read his book, Give Us His Day, on this whole thing, he's very bitter because he thinks that the Kennedys have got it out for Dulles during this whole hearing thing. And, of course, the only reason the Kennedys had out for Dulles is because when Bobby Kennedy was serving on that committee, he couldn't get a straight answer out of Alan Dulles, all right, because he never believed that Dulles was being honest about whether or not he really thought that that operation was going to succeed. And we later found out through a scholar named Vandenbroek from Princeton, who found these coffee-stained notes in which Dulles was going to write his whole version of the Bay of Pigs operation, in which in those notes he admitted that he did not believe that Operation Zapata, which was the code name for the Bay of Pigs, was going to succeed. But he felt that once JFK saw it failing, he would go ahead and call in the Navy and, therefore, through American intervention, that would save the operation. All right? And so he later admitted that, such was the case. But the problem was that about 9 days before the launch of the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy had gone on television and said, in no uncertain terms, there would be no American intervention in Cuba. And he was not about to go back on that, all right, even though the CIA and everybody else was trying to urge him to do so. I mean, I interviewed Victor Marchetti, former CIA officer and analyst, at his office in Virginia, and he told me that Deputy Director of the CIA, Charles Gabel, told him during the three-day crisis of the Bay of Pigs, he came down to his office and said, I need a report from you saying there's MIGs in Cuba. And Marchetti said, I can't do that because there are no MIGs in Cuba. And he goes, well, how do you know that? Because we have pictures of all the things coming in, the Soviet freighters, and I know what it takes to put a plane together, and those boxes are not there. And Cabell left in a huff. But this is how they were going to try and pressure Kennedy into going ahead and using American Marines and the American Navy. And Hunt was very upset that this was more or less found out. Okay, and that very properly, in the end, Bobby Kennedy and a man who his father, Joe Kennedy, knew, a guy named Robert Lovett, you know, went to the president's office and said, you know, this is the opportunity for you to go ahead and get rid of this guy. You know, and by the way, and to really accent that, to show how what a nutty right winger Howard Hunt was. See, by this time,
Jim, let me jump in. We are almost out of time in this interview. I think maybe let's pick up E. Howard Hunt and his extreme views, and then present more of the Cuban dramatis personae in our next talk, because people certainly have had their interest whetted, and as I mentioned, this is holiday gift-giving season. Those who would like to do a deeper dive into your work on your website, why don't you tell them about that, and where they can get a hold of not only Destiny Betrayed, but your other book as well, and we'll also tell them about Black Op Radio.
All right. My website is kennedysandking.com. And you'll see links to Destiny Betrayed and the JFK assassination, the evidence today, right there on the first page. And you can click through and you can order those books. And I'm also like a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's program, Black Op Radio, out of Vancouver.
There you go, Kennedys and King and Black Op Radio. For those who would like to pursue this information, and again, Destiny Betrayed would make a superb holiday gift. This concludes For the Record program number 1033, interview number 3 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 20th of the year 2018. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.